Welcome, everybody. Wow, is that too loud back there? I talk about this loud, just as a for you guys. Welcome to Vanity to Value, Metrics That Matter, Lean and Agile, Kanban and Scrum, if you would. My name is Stephen Borg. I'm the co-founder and strategist at Northwest Cadence. And that's my email and my Twitter address. That's part of housekeeping as well. We're going to talk about feedback and we're going to talk about metrics today. And my feedback from you is the evaluations. So, who here is going to fill out an evaluation at the end of this? Awesome. Thank you very much. Who here is not? We got one guy in the back. I will not. I will not. All right. Let's start off with some poorly thought-through metrics. And I bring these up because I love some of these. Not catching your flight home. We all flew in, not all of us, some from Houston, but many of us flew in. In the US, they had an interesting thing that they did. JetBlue sat on the tarmac for 7 hours, waiting to take off. Bathrooms overflowed, they had to lock them, it was terrible. In response to that, the Federal Aviation Administration said if you pull away and you sit for X minutes, and I don't know the minutes, on the tarmac, the airline is fined an enormous amount of money. It's thousands of dollars per passenger. This is not a small amount. What happened the month after that was implemented? The number of flight cancellations in America tripled. Right? Because you go wait. They don't know for sure if they can take off. They'd rather cancel the flight than get you on and pull away from the gate. Very interesting things. Hard hiking trips. If you lived in Russia in the 50s and 60s, or the Soviet Union at the time, the people making camping gear were measured their output by ton. So do you make really lightweight camping gear? No way. You make big, heavy pots and pans. Then we get to the classics. Amazon.com suffered this, they learned. A metric to measure the effectiveness of their phone support. You'd call Amazon, and they got paid by the number of phone calls they talked to, or bonus, not paid, but bonuses based on the number of calls they answered. So if you call and I talk to you for 5 minutes and I hang up, what do? You call back. It might go to me, it might go to somebody else, but I've doubled the number of calls that I've made. Poor customer service as a result of a metric. Metrics can be dangerous things. My favorite, and I am going to use this story forever and ever, is getting tech support until bankruptcy. And this is Gateway. How many remember Gateway? A ton of you. They used to ship their computers in these big boxes that kind of looked like cows and stuff like that. They put in an interesting metric. You couldn't hang up on your people. That was not okay. So they had a metric to protect against that. But then they said, if you don't solve the problem, and I forgot the number of minutes now. I think it was 17 minutes. If you don't solve the person's problem in 17 minutes that calls to you, you cannot get a bonus for that week. What happened? They couldn't hang up, and they had to solve the problem, so they didn't call back. Their number of returns went up 700%. Because Knut's going to give me a call, right? He gives me a call. He says, "Hey, my computer won't work." And I say, "Great, what's the problem?" "I don't know. I pushed the on button, it doesn't go in." I say, "Is it plugged in?" Knut says, "Yes." I say, "It's probably broken. Send it in. I'll send you a replacement." Less than 17 minutes. Metrics are dangerous things. By the way, I told that a tech ed ago or two tech eds ago, that same metric, and somebody was frantically waving, and they came up to the microphone and said, "I worked at Gateway." At this point, panic sets in, right? And he was actually a technical support at Gateway during this time. And what's going through my mind is, I hope all the stuff I read on the internet is true. Those is kind of your it's kind of your engagement, right? And he came up and he said, "That's all true, but it's probably not what drove us to bankruptcy." They kept modulating, swinging back and forth with metrics that caused us to go one way and the other, and trying to get people motivated for behaviors, and it basically drove this radical swinging back and forth until we just fell apart as a technical support organization. Metrics have consequences. They have very real consequences. So today we're going to talk about why metrics. Provide a giant list of metrics. We're not going to spend a lot of time on the giant list of metrics. But those metrics are ones that you've probably seen before. And we'll talk through some of those. Characteristics of a good metric. Very brief introduction to Kanban and Scrum. How many Scrum teams are here? How many Kanban teams are here? How many Scrumban teams are here? They kind of mix them up a little bit. How many do nothing? They do waterfall-ish or spiral or something else, a different model. Okay, good. So I'm going to talk about why the metrics are different between those and why you might choose to use different metrics in Kanban and Scrum than you use in traditional software development. Then we're going to talk about those metrics. I'm going to talk about one metric to rule them all, the one metric you need to track. There's probably more, but we'll talk about that one metric that I'm pretty passionate about. I'll bang that drum a bit. And then do a case study and show off a little piece of a way of looking at things, looking through software. So here's the bottom line on metrics. Russell Ackoff, he died before Twitter, and it's a pity, because he has an abundance of these wonderful quotes. Managers who don't know how to measure what they want settle for wanting what they can measure. So when you provide a list of metrics to your management, which may be you, chances are that's the behavior that they're going to be wanting to optimize, and that's what they're going to want to look at. So we have to be extraordinarily careful that we provide the right metrics to management. We can provide some very harmful metrics that will change our behavior and management's behavior so that we can break the company and drive them into bankruptcy. Then there's the Wisiati problem, what you see is all there is. When people have metrics in front of them, they kind of get blinded by stuff that sits outside of those metrics. We want to be cautious of those sorts of things. Let me give you a quick example, and I like this example. I've used it before, so if you've seen me talk before, you'll recognize it. Utilization versus productivity, and we're going to come back to this later with some newer stuff, and capacity versus flow. This is my calendar when I went to a lean conference in 2011. Last week, I went to the same conference. They have learned their lesson. Look, however, in 2011, 3 years ago, what happened? The schedules were crammed together. And if you look at the first keynote right there is called Fundamental Secrets of the Universe. That keynote is going to go long, right? You know that keynote's going to go long. So it pushed into the next thing, which was Scrum Music Collaboration, kind of a strange thing. But it kept pushing down. People were missing. There's no gaps between sessions. Imagine if the previous presenter was up here while he's finishing talking, I'm getting everything set up so I can just pull things over. It was a disaster. We need to have Slack. This is a fully utilized freeway. Completely useless. But you all know project managers who would look at this freeway and go, wait, I see a spot we could fit a motorcycle. Let's get one in there. Right? You've got that. You have that. You know those people. I love this quote from Jim Benson. Capacity is how much stuff will fit. Throughput is how much stuff will flow. And they are not synonymous. But what we measure is very often utilization. I walk by your desk, are you typing as a developer or are you looking at the ceiling? If you're looking at the ceiling, I'm gonna come in and yell at you and tell you to start typing, right? As if sending someone to Mavis Beacon teaches typing will make them a better developer. It's a thought, it's a thing, but yet as managers, and I'm a manager here too, we tend to look at that and go, oh, they're not using their time effectively. We have to be cautious. This is my calendar. Exactly 1 week later. And I have gaps in it all the way down until I get card time. These gaps are calls that I'm making. And then I have a pause. And during the pause, I don't just waste the time. I pick something up and do it. But if I'm on a sales call, I don't want to rush off the sales call and hang it up. so that I can get on another sales call. I want to be able to answer questions and work through that. I'm a much more effective person when I don't, when I'm not overloaded with work. So I just wanted to throw some of those out because I think they're important. I love this. How many people's organizations are geared towards getting 100% utilization? Everybody working in their field 100% of the time. Some. And that's a dangerous thing. We'll talk about why it's dangerous in a moment. Here's my giant list of metrics. Now, I'm going to go through them quickly, but the metrics here come from more of a mature software development type organizations. It's kind of hard to talk on this side. Apologies to the folks over here. It's easier to stand over there. Here's some of the giant list of metrics. Bugs per 1,000 lines of code, bugs per story point, bugs per user story, bug rates, release to release, mean time to repair, etc. These are things that people measure, some defect style metrics. When we look at project metrics, there's a few in here. Earned value, I have a particular passion against, hatred for. I can talk why afterwards if you bring it up. Schedule estimation accuracy. This comes out of Microsoft Project. They measure it for you. You plan a year in advance. How much did your plan change? Boom. Your estimation accuracy was only 70%. If I walk into a company and their schedule estimation accuracy for a year-long project is 100%, I've got serious doubts whether they delivered the right stuff. Right? Because if you spent a year building software and you learned nothing that would change your plan, you're not getting feedback. You're just rote grinding away at a backlog and not paying attention to what's happening. I have a particular hatred there. Utilization, we'll talk about that one. Code metrics, I like this one. There's some good code metrics here. Code coverage, we'll talk about that later. I think that's an okay one. Number of undiscovered bugs released to production. Anyone? You can measure it. I'm not saying you should, but you can measure it or estimate it. How many of you have heard of fish and game? They measure like how many fish are in a lake and that kind of stuff. How do they do that? Do they just throw a bunch of dynamite in the lake and count the fish that float? No. They catch 1,000, tag those 1,000, throw them back in, wait a week for them to distribute, and then they catch another 1,000 fish. And if they caught in the second batch of thousands, if 1,000 of them all had tags, there's probably 1,000 fish in the lake, give or take, right? Chances of that would be way too small. If they caught 100 fish with tags, it's probably somewhere around 10,000. Now, there's some Bayesian statistics involved. You get a distribution. But you can measure that. Microsoft has the data to measure that. Have you ever submitted a bug on Connect? Anyone, you submit bugs on Connect with your stuff. Did you browse through all 25,000 Connect bugs to see if yours was a duplicate? No, you didn't. You just filed it and then you went. Microsoft could measure the number of bugs in Visual Studio that have not yet been reported with that data. I'm just throwing that out there. There's some fun stuff. You can measure more than you want, more than you think. Here's some more customer metrics. Bugs reported per user per month. Customer satisfaction, those sorts of things. Good metrics. Code coverage, number of requirements changes. People treat that one as a bad thing. Again, for the same reason as schedule estimation accuracy, I'd argue that might not make sense. It might be a good thing. So what is a metric that matters? How do you make a metric or understand an effective metric? I've read a lot on metrics, and there's probably a million different ways, but I keep settling in on a similar approach, which is it should be comparable. If the metric isn't comparable with itself over time, with between teams potentially, if it's not comparable with anything, don't bother measuring it. Story points are comparable inside of a team over time. That's fairly effective. That's a comparable metric. They're not comparable across teams. So Sometimes I wish they were, but they're not. It needs to be simple. How many of you have done advanced calculus? In your head. All right? So we are really good creatures at optimizing one or two variables if we understand those variables. But you give us something really complicated, and we have to figure out what behavioral change could I make that would maximize this metric? I'm not going to be able to figure it out. Same thing if I have too many metrics. If you're a leader and you're trying to change behaviors, you got two metrics, maybe three. You're pushing it with four. Because people don't do four metrics. They don't do maximization problems with four variables very well. So you have to be very cautious. So at any given time, you only get to push a few metrics. We're just not good at that. So they got to keep it simple. I think metrics should be actionable. You need to be able to come back and take some action. If I am gathering reports and going and saying, here's my TPS report to my boss or whatever, right? And nobody even looks at it, chances are that's a useless metric. And I challenge you, if you submit metrics like that a lot in an attachment to an email, attach a blank document sometime and just see if you get a response. Because if you don't get a response, you know where all that is going, right? Just into the ether. And it's got to be honest. And this is hard. Honest means that when the metric is moving upward, if that's where you want it to move, that the company's value is aligned and is also moving upward. In other words, you don't want people lying just to get good metrics. Here's a stupid example, right? There's three lines of code. Is this more effective? No, never. We don't measure lines of code as a measure of productivity for this reason, at least benefiting people on it or bonusing it on it. So here's a distinction I want to call out, and we're going to come back to this distinction when we talk about the one metric. You have the true metric, what you want to measure and what you should measure. You also have a proxy metric. And the proxy metric is what you can measure. Those two are, you want them to be related. You can't always measure the true metric. You have to measure a proxy. I want my company to have success and spread the word in social media. Right? So I can do a number of things. I can pay a firm who will get me a bunch of Facebook likes. That may make me look good as the social media person who runs the company, but it does absolutely no good for the true value to the company if a bunch of people are simply liking it because they're getting paid. We've got to have the right metrics. So we've got to be careful when we measure with proxy metrics. Now, here's a few metrics, and I just want to throw in a couple. A defect removal efficiency. I'm going to come back to this a little bit later. This is the percentage of bugs that you caught and removed before you went to production divided by that number plus the bugs that you found 1 year after release. It's an old metric, right? 1 year between releases, that's crazy talk, but that's kind of the idea. Defect removal efficiency has some interesting correlations with productivity that we'll talk about in a moment. Code coverage, not always honest. How many of you unit test? If you don't put an assert statement in your unit test, does it pass or fail? It passes! Yeah, I'm not saying people would ever do that, but it is something you have to look out for. Performance profiling, test cases per feature, bugs per feature. Lines of code, not always honest. Function points, effort. I do TFS implementations a lot, and there's often this question of me, can I track my time in TFS so I don't have to track it and duplicate entry into my timekeeping system? And my answer is no, duplicate entry. Because one place you're going to lie and one place you're going to tell the truth. You don't want people lying in TFS. People enter 40 hours a week as the number of hours of work that they worked. That's just what they put. It adds up to 40 magically, whether they worked 60 or whether they worked 20. It adds up to 40 somehow. You're going to lie in your timekeeping system. Tell the truth in TFS so we can predict more accurately. If you actually spent 60 hours, don't list 40. Because next time we go to estimate a project, that extra 20 hours that you spent that week will just be baked in and will be an expectation for the next one. Anyway, I just want to throw that out there. Velocity, not always simple. Lines of code per developer per day. Wrong. Quality. The iron triangle, right? There's the iron triangle. You have scope, you've got budget, you've got time. One of them's going to give. And people say, no, no, it's a tetrahedron. There's also quality. And you can sacrifice quality to go faster. And you can once. Capers Jones, he studied 20-some-odd thousand software developers projects, software development projects, and he found the metric. He's a metrics guy. He writes all the books on metrics. He found that the number one metric correlated with speed of delivery was high quality. The higher the quality, the faster teams could deliver. It is exactly opposite of what people expect. Quality is job one. You're delivering very rapidly. Why? Because you go really quickly. You get some bugs. Those bugs feed back as a failure demand. Now instead of 100% of the time on features, you're spending 80. You ship a bunch of cruddy code because now you're in a bigger rush. Now you're spending 50% of your time on failures and 50% on delivering new features. Don't ever sacrifice quality for speed. If you're trying to go fast, there's times to sacrifice quality. It's when you're doing an experiment or that sort of thing, but that's a little bit different. Some user metrics: satisfaction, post-release bug count, number of help desk calls. We know that's not always honest. Click. Business metrics. How many people measure ROI, return on investment, an estimated ROI? And then for you two, three, four, do you come back after the project and say, did we hit it? Most companies don't. So they use it to prioritize their metrics, to prioritize their portfolio, but then they just ignore it. They don't actually measure the ROI. I find that interesting. Most of you are doing Scrum or Kanban, so this is going to be really quick, but I do want to level set folks. We're going to shift now from the metrics, the big metrics, to littler metrics. And the littler metrics, the smaller metrics, the lean and agile metrics are different. And they're different in what we measure, but they're functionally different for a reason. So before we get that, a very, very brief introduction of Scrum and Kanban. Scrum is an iterative approach to software. Folks, I know I'm simplifying here. You have to cut me slack. Anyone from Scrum.org or Scrum Alliance, I'm going to be totally simplifying this. You have a product backlog. You chop it into a smaller subset of work that you deliver in 1 to 4 weeks with a preference for the shorter time scale. That's your sprint backlog. And every day, you work against it, and you have a stand-up meeting. It's the 24 hours, the daily scrum. And at the end, you have some working software that goes out the other end. And then you rinse and repeat on the next sprint. And you may not release to production at every sprint, or you might. Kanban, and again, for anybody from Lean Kanban University, I apologize. I'm going to simplify greatly. Kanban, in the way it's experienced in most places, does not have iteration boundaries. It's a continuous flow model. Things just kind of get dropped in, and it goes across. You visualize your work in Kanban. You must put a board up somewhere or have an electronic board. You have to have visualized work. You make policies explicit. What does it flow across? You limit your work in process. You go in and you say, test can only have two items in test. You go to release, you go to done, etc. And then you commit to, you focus on flow and commit to continuous improvement. Scrum, day one to the last day, you know, you make progress. It looks like you're making progress. Kanban, every day is kind of similar in a lot of ways. That's a strength and a weakness. Here's a few other differences that we don't need to get into. The idea is that both Scrum and Kanban do something unique when compared to traditional Big Bang approaches. I'll call it waterfall for lack of a better term, but long planning horizons. They're reducing the amount of work that you commit to a small chunk and getting it done. And when I say done, I mean done, meaning it's been built and tested. Or done, built, tested, and released, however you want to look at it. So that's kind of a quick, blazing fast introduction to Scrum and Kanban. Are there any questions before I move on? People pretty comfortable there? So let's talk about the metrics for those two. Here's a list of metrics that I had to work very hard to find that are used in Scrum teams. There are others. Some of them use some of the old metrics we saw earlier, but I highlighted two, velocity and burndown. In Scrum, these are the two metrics that you use to measure progress. That's it. Two. In Kanban, you have work in process that you measure as a metric, and lead time, how fast from when you start something until it's done. Those are the two things you measure. And there's some other things you might measure. But why do Scrum and Kanban demand so little of our metrics brains? Thoughts? Yeah, I love that answer. Work is sized so small, you don't have to have all this formality around it. You can have smaller chunks. And here's why they're simple. We need to focus on fast software delivery. Feedback is king, and we're targeting the highest risks. Now, this goes to Steve McConnell, who Code Complete. He's won 3 Jolt Cola Awards for his book. Like, that's unheard of, right, for his books. And he has a study that I'm always, the numbers work out too perfectly, so it always seems a bit weird. But he says that in software development teams, 90% of our efforts inside the organization to protect and deliver software correctly are geared towards handling the technical risks, the iron triangle, scope, budget, time, and we manage that and we monitor it and we have project managers who manage it and monitor it and watch it. And if it's going off track, we make changes. We add resources. We pull resources off. We add new things. We focus 90% of our efforts on that technical risk. And 10% of our efforts are out talking with customers, engaging with our users. But in reality, the risks are inverse to that. Your software project will not go off the rails if you have to throw an extra 10% of a budget against it. But it will go off the rails if you deliver the wrong code. The risk in software development is from the marketplace. It's from the market. It's not from failing to deliver on your iron triangle. If your ROI, I'm going to go back to that, is so tight on your software development project that if you go over 10%, your ROI is shot, you're building the wrong thing. Because software scales like there's nothing else. You should be working on ROIs of 1,000 to 10,000%. You don't work on little ROIs. We're too immature as an industry to be working on that. There's still so much that we can pick from to build high ROI things. So focus on getting that right. And that's what Scrum does. At the end of a release, or at the end of a sprint, you do a demo. You show it to your stakeholders, and you say, is this what you want? And they say, no, you don't have an idea of what we want. I love what you built, but it's completely wrong. Go back and try again. I've lost a week or 2 weeks worth of effort. I go back and I fix it and I get what the customers want. People say the failure rates in Agile are much lower than they are in Waterfall. That's not true. You fail a lot more in Agile than you will ever fail in Waterfall. Because in Waterfall, in a one-year project, you fail once at the end. If you're doing one-week sprints, you may fail 20% of the time. The idea behind Kanban and Scrum is fail faster so you can succeed sooner. You want to get that feedback back. Feedback is king. And that's that area where feedback just absolutely trumps. So one metric, the one metric which rules them all, this is the true metric. You're going to have to come up with your own proxy metrics. That true metric is time to feedback. Time to feedback is when I make a decision and I take action, how fast until I understand whether that action or decision paid off? Is it a day? Is it a week? Is it 10 days, 10 months? How fast is that feedback? And I want you to measure that particular feedback. Not at this conference. I'm staying at a nice hotel just down the way. So it wasn't here, but a conference a while ago, I was speaking at a conference, and I was standing there naked, and in the shower, by the shower, reaching in and feeling the water. And the water was cold. I turned it up. The water was cold. I turned it up. The water was still cold. Cranked the thing up. It's finally warm enough, so I step into the shower, and then all of a sudden, it's way too hot, and I'm back out, right? The feedback mechanism was so long, and it took me forever to turn the water back down to hit the right temperature. That feedback loop was extraordinarily wasteful. On the Iron Triangle, I broke resources, right? I used a lot more water, right? I had too much time. I wasted time, right? And my effort involved, my scope, scope didn't change a whole lot. I still needed to just wash my hair and stuff. But this is incredible amounts of waste that you get when you have slow feedback. That was my water in process, my whip, right, in the shower. So here's your feedback loop. Measure, adjust, measure, adjust, measure, adjust. How fast can you get through this loop? And when you throw in a delay, this is what breaks you. This delay stops you from effectively handling anything that's coming your way. So we want to get fast feedback. Now, I have a rant. I need to take a moment and talk about where we focus on feedback that's wrong. And I'm going to go over to this side because I'm rarely over here. We focus on this process right here, the run. We focus on this middle one, and we do a lot of attention to people in the run state. And the run state is coding, if you're a dev, testing, if you're a tester. So we're going to give developers better tools, testers better tools, training, everything so that they can do their job faster. But there's a bigger context we have to pay attention to. And that context is you're sitting in a queue somewhere. The work sits there waiting for a developer to pick it up. Developer picks it up. There's some setup time. The setup time is where the developer is thinking, understanding, opening up Visual Studio, getting the right source code, getting set up. Run is the coding piece. Wait is now I'm done, finish up, I drop it off, and I move it into where? A tester queue, where it sits in another queue. I urge you to look at the overall system cycle time, not the cycle time of just the developers typing. In your organization, queue, setup, run, wait, move. This is when you're working. Everything else is not working effort. That's your touch time. What percentage of the time are you actually working on a requirement? From the time compared to the time it's the requirement started work on until it ships into production? What percentage of time are people actually working on it? Building it, architecting it, testing it, deploying it? Percentage-wise, give me some answers. 75? 75? 5? Yeah, 5's a little closer to what most teams are. 20%. 8 to 10%, 17.39%. I hear a winner. Right on. No. The best Kanban teams I've watched crest periodically to 50% touch time, and then go back down to about 20%. Very high efficiency teams run at about 20% touch time compared to overall time. Most companies are in the 2 to 3%, 4% if they're doing Scrum, and they're in the point something percent if they're doing Waterfall. It's not as fast as most people estimate. Most of the time, it's hanging out in those other states. So, slow feedback. There's just so much bad stuff to say about slow feedback. It introduces a lot more work into the system, folks. Lot more work because I'm a developer. I go in, I start coding. I now run into a bug. I code it up, I pass it, it goes through wait, move, queues for the tester goes into setup, tests it, finds a bug, puts it back in my queue, and then I get a hold of it again. If the period of time is more than 2 weeks, at least with my code, it might as well have been written by somebody else. Because I'm going to look at that code and go, who wrote this terrible code? It's awful code. We want that feedback to be much, much faster. Good teams, you want to get that. I've seen teams get that feedback down to hours between coding and test. And that's pretty amazing because if you're down to a couple hours, I code it, it's tested, tester comes back to me in that time, that code is still fresh in my mind, I can make the change very, very rapidly. The setup costs as a developer are nil. 2 weeks, the setup costs, just to kind of get my brain back into it, might be an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to fix a 15-minute bug. You're wasting a lot of developer time. It's the same thing for testers. If testers find a bug immediately and pass it back to the dev, and then the dev sits on it for 2 weeks, the tester gets back and they said, how was I testing this? It is so much waste that gets piled into these systems by this thing. It adds a lot more complexity. You have a ton of context switching. And what's worse, it just decimates productivity. No, decimates is the wrong word. Decimates means 1 out of every 10 units of productivity. It does a lot worse than that. Teams that get fast feedback will see their performance increase relatively dramatically. That's one of the best things you can do to get fast feedback. You also build to get productivity. You also tend to build the wrong thing. If you're building stuff and you don't get feedback from your customers for 2 months, where do you go with that? You know, you're building on a lot of stuff. So there's some warnings that I want to kick in and some danger points. Any metric. When a metric becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. People will eventually change their behaviors to maximize whatever metric you're measuring. Usually that's a proxy metric, so you have to swap out proxy metrics every now and again. One company I was at, very, very awkward. They had just gone through a bunch of lean training, and the cycle time for bug fixes had been reduced dramatically by about 75%. And we didn't know any of the details behind that, and my company did an assessment of their development practices. We found something that was very odd. Whenever bugs came in, they stayed in an Excel spreadsheet until they were about to work on them, and then they dropped them into TFS and the time started. Well, we just thought this is a really bad idea. Why are you doing this? So we put it in our assessment and presented the assessment. And one of the managers there had just gotten a 5-figure bonus based on that reduction. That's an embarrassing situation for him, and he did not know his team was doing it. He didn't even know. These are things that you've got to watch out for, and you've got to pay attention to your metrics. I love lead time, but man, if people are faking it, it's a dangerous one. So I want you to recall the true metric versus the proxy metric. Time to feedback is a true metric. It's a metric that is a good metric to come back and look at, but it's extremely difficult to measure on its own. How do you put up something and says, our time to feedback is 3.9? 3.9 what? What feedback? Where are we getting? So we have proxy metrics instead. And metrics are contextual. You're going to have your own proxies in your organizations. I can't tell you what those are. One of my favorites is I think we're moving from a world of shipping software to a world of on-demand services that are always on. And there's a mental shift between services and software that we have to be concerned about. In software, you care about mean time to failure. You want someone to install their software and not have very many bugs. That's the key metric. That's the thing you care about. In services, you care about mean time to realize, recover, repair, and remediate. To find the bug, get out there and fix it so that people aren't running into the problem. Fast fixing is more important than not having the bugs in the first place. By the way, I put 4 R's up here. You want to. This might be a good measure if you're running a service. How long till you realize there's a problem from when it was introduced? How long does it take you to recover from that problem? That's just the faking it out, right? Rolling back, doing whatever. How long does it take you to repair the problem? That's to fix the problem. And then how long does it take you to, I couldn't think of a good R word. If somebody else can, I'd love it. Remediate, which is find the root cause and eliminate the root cause so that that class of errors does not exist again. That's one. Work in process, I'll show in a moment, is actually a wonderful feedback, time to feedback proxy, as is queue length. Lead time over cycle time, that touch time things. Code coverage, mean time to customer feedback. Touch time versus lead time. I talked about that earlier. Here's some tools that we use to get feedback faster. We don't often build things always. We might run an experiment. So for those of you who are in Scrum and in Kanban, we tend to think of the product owner as the source of our backlog items. And the product owner has a vision of the marketplace. We execute the vision of the marketplace in sprints. We show it to customers. We get feedback from the marketplace so that we can change the understanding in the product manager's head so that we can reprioritize and build more effectively. We're continually reaching out to the world, finding out if we're right, and pulling it back. That's a type of experiment. But I'm seeing teams now use a different color card for a pure experiment. In other words, when you're a product owner and you write out a user story, you have acceptance criteria. What does it mean for you as a developer to be done? And it's clear and concise. And sometimes as a product owner, you have no clue. Product owners? None. If you're a product owner, you probably at some point go, I have no idea. I don't know if this is valuable. I want to try it. And you can try it in two ways, build the whole thing or do an experiment. I worked with an e-commerce firm, and I loved this. We were sitting there talking, and they said, we want to track people's zip code when they hit the site because we ship stuff to them from lots of different locations, and we want to minimize the shipping costs to those people. So when they search for something, they wanted to sort the returns to include the shipping price and prioritize so they could minimize shipping price because people tend to buy the things at the top. And they went through their sprint planning, and it looked like that was going to be about 2 sprints worth of work to rejigger their whole ordering system. And I asked the question, do people actually enter zip codes at the beginning? Will they actually enter zip codes, or will they want to wait until the checkout? They said, we don't know. So rather than that whole process, they simply put a zip code tracking request at the front of their web page that went nowhere. Nowhere. It didn't prioritize anything, didn't change the results. All it was there to do was to measure whether or not they could get at least 30% of the people to click the button. That would cost Justify to enter their zip code and click it. That would cost Justify them for building their infrastructure, they felt. Run an experiment. Have something, a card that's super lightweight. Prototyping, that would be a prototype. Pretotyping, there's a whole book called Pretotyping that says prototypes are way too big. Build really tiny, small things. There's an example of a company in Silicon Valley, and this is how they got really fast feedback. You'd take your phone, and here was their product. You would take your phone, and you would take a photo of the food that you were about to eat. That photo would then be uploaded to their servers. Some pretty fancy algorithms would parse through that, determine what you were eating, match that to the calorie, fat count, etc., from those types of food, and at the end of the day, send you an email saying, you need to do a lot better. You ate way too much of that snack mix at Tech Ed. Right? That was going to cost a lot of money to build. So what did he do? He built a little app for a phone, submitted it, and all it did was gather your photographs, and he would send it to a bunch of nutrition students who were at university. And they would manually look it up, enter all the data, and then feed it back to his automated email thing. No AI whatsoever. He saved about $2 million on the AI. Wildly popular. Until he started asking people to pay for it. Wildly unpopular. It was an awesome novelty when people thought there was some cool AI behind the scenes doing it, but nobody forked over cash for it. He folded up shop at a cost of about $200,000. Small price to pay rather than investing $2 million up front. Think of things you can do to get feedback really, really fast without having to build things necessarily. Other things, continuous delivery is a great way to do this. Feature flags are a great one. You deploy your application, and you can turn on features for a subset of your people who are safe. You've seen a lot of VSO stuff, right? Visual Studio Online? Many of you have probably seen some of those demos. If I go to my VSO account, I'm a Microsoft MVP. I see things you don't see. Why? Because I'm trusted that I'm not going to slam Microsoft. I'm going to give them feedback. They can build up their service. And if you're from Microsoft, you see things I don't get to see because you're even more trusted, right? You turn on features for people to get that feedback quickly. Unit testing, another feedback one. Cross-functional teams, another great way to get feedback. There's a lot of ways to get feedback fast. Let's talk about some of those. This is called a cumulative flow diagram. We're going to run through it quick. Up in the upper left, you've got some assigned work. And now we have a line. If I'm on the line, I've picked up the work and started working on it. Right? So I start work on something. And over time, I'm going to complete some of this work. Right? So I start the work, time passes, I finish the work. I'm taking more and more and more work as I go, and I'm finishing more and more and more work. What I have in the middle is the work in process, WIP. I want you to get really familiar with the term WIP. This is, at a date, the WIP that I have, and given this date, if I have a pretty consistent lines, I can estimate what my average lead time is going to be. So I have work in process, and lead time. Lead time is my time to feedback. If I put something into the process that takes 3 weeks to get out, that's the fastest I can get feedback at that piece of work. So let's say I've got 6 items in work in process. Hey, Knut, I'm going to pick on you again, because you're right up front. You're just begging for it. You, as an executive, walk in and say to everyone here, if you go above 3 items of work in process, you're fired. He lays down the law. He makes an executive decision. What does that do? It means that this line, this middle black line, will never be more than 3 above my completed work. I will only ever work on 3 things at a time at most. That, in turn, does some interesting things to my expected average lead time. Assuming this slope is positive, which it better be, or we need to fire the team, you're going to reduce your lead time. This is the secret sauce of consultants. We ask you to reduce your work in process. And if we can get you to do so, magical things happen. Our goal is just to get you to do that reduction in work in process. Let's do math. Several people raised their hands for calculus, so we're going to dive into some theory here. But first, to deliver value more frequently, reduce your work in progress or process. Here's 2 minutes of math. Here's the graphic. And here's the implications of this graphic. The delivery rate, this slope there, how fast you deliver, is equal to the work in progress or process divided by the lead time. Doing a little munging around and moving things, says lead time is then equal to the work in process divided by the delivery rate. You guys don't have that much control over your delivery rate. I hate to tell this to you. You can't just magically wave a wand and your developers develop twice as fast. Your delivery rate is in the short term fixed. But you can dramatically reduce your lead time by chopping your work in progress. And here's the kicker. This is why this metric is so important. Unlike virtually all metrics that we run into in software development, work in process is a leading indicator. It's a leading indicator, not a lagging indicator. That means we get a heads up of something going wrong. We know ahead of time that our software process is going downhill. You know how this works, right? If you're at a grocery store and there's one checkout clerk and he's cranking through as fast as he can, checking people out, and there's 25 people in line, they don't wait until the 25th person comes up all angry and ask them how long it took them to get up here. They look up, see that there's a big line, and they say, check out on aisle 5, or whatever. Check out in front, whatever they say, and other people come and distribute that workload. It's a leading indicator, and we have that ability to have that leading indicator in software development. The difficult problem is, and this presentation is not the right place for it, but it come up afterwards, and I'll talk through at more depth. Our work in process is almost invisible. It's a list in some computer system. There's nothing fundamentally visual to bother us about our work in process. Our work in process is bits and bytes on a hard drive. And we have giant hard drives. We don't run out of space from our work. That work has got to be visualized. Kanban and Scrum, both, put it up on a wall. This is what we're doing. And if there's too much stuff there, people freak out. I love the suggestion Andrew had to a customer of ours. They had a lot of work in process on their Kanban board, and they weren't paying attention to how much stuff they were doing. And who's the guy that's the most that gathers the most work in process? It's always your most critical function, right? It's the person who knows the entire system. They've got all the work, and they pile it all up because they're the only ones who can do it quickly and efficiently. He just said, you guys, you got small, medium, and large work. Off to Home Depot, back with boxes. Small boxes, medium boxes, and large boxes. Pile them all up. Put the sticky on them. This is your work. You take it to your office. You walk by people's offices, and you look in, and you go, what? You've got 12 large boxes in your office. I know the relationship. More work in process, much longer lead time. If I look in and I see anything important on those 12 boxes, I know I'm not getting it fast. Visualize your work. Bring it out in the open. Shine a bright light on it. Kanban does that brilliantly. It's one of the fundamentals of Kanban, but so does Scrum. So manage cues. They're that leading indicator of upcoming problems. Now, more math. What was your name? What?
Juan.
I'm picking on Juan. All right. So I'm going to take Juan, and I'm going to define some stuff for y'all. We talked about utilization. In the abstract, why you came here, maybe, is because I'm telling you measuring utilization is bad. We're now about to get there. Juan, I want you to unscrew this lid. You don't actually have to come up. I'm going to want you to unscrew this lid. I hand it to Juan, and he was coming up here immediately. He was going to do it right now. He was not utilized. You were unutilized at the moment in time I brought this to you. If I brought you another one and you said, yeah, I'll get to it as soon as I finish, I don't care how short a time it is, you were utilized. I'm defining utilization that way. If I come to him 100 times with my bottle of water to unscrew the lid, and 99 times he says, yes, put it in that pile, I'll get to it, he's utilized 99% of the time. Is that a fair way to measure utilization? Okay. Now notice, you were doing other things, but when I came to you, this was what your job was, you came and did it. He might be doing other effective things during the time that you're unutilized, but your utilization, you were unutilized if you could immediately grab this and work with it. So in order to keep you utilized, I've got to have a backlog of items for you. Because if he's never utilized, what am I paying you for? Juan, you're just wasting my money, right? So you've got to give him a backlog. But if that backlog is small like this, how long is it going to take for you to unscrew two bottles and get to my red bottle? It's going to be fast. It's going to be really, really quick. But you might run out of work. And as a manager, if you run out of work, what am I paying you for? Right? You're just playing foosball. So what do? I give you a lot more work. Oh, crud. Now I want you to open up this bottle of water because I want a drink. How long is it going to take? Longer. You got other stuff on your plate. I promise this math won't hurt. M. This is a Markov chain. Juan works at his job at a variable rate. Sorry, I give him stuff at a variable rate. I've been asking you periodically, but it hasn't been exactly 1 minute between every time I ask you. I'm giving it to you in a variable rate. Juan works at a variable rate. He does things. Some things take longer, sometimes they take shorter, but you work at a variable rate. How many of there are you, Juan? Juan. And I'm going to assume that that Q can go to infinity. Now, for those of you who are mathematically inclined, you may recognize this as the MM1 infinity Q. This is a very well-known Q in queuing theory. So we have lead time running up the side. We've got lead time up the side, and you've got utilization across the bottom. Bear with me. If I give something to Juan and his utilization is very, very low, his lead time, bam, he turns it around immediately. However, as time progresses, if he's utilized 99% of the time, I'm going to have to wait. And in order for him to be utilized 99% of the time, I have to give him a big enough queue that it's going to be a long wait for me. That's the graph. It asymptotically approaches 100%, I mean infinity, at 100%. Anyone heard of a company called Google? Google. It's a web search company. No. Google does this crazy thing where you get 20% time. Right? What? That's nuts. They're letting people just do stuff on their own. Juan's working on his electric acoustic guitar simulator for the web. Right? Why would they do that? Notice what happens when you drop your utilization just 20%. Now, I've got a question for Knut. If you're not done with your work Monday through Wednesday and you're at Google, and I don't know, I don't work there, do you think Friday morning you just say, I'll get to that next Monday? Or do you think you finish it off and then get to your acoustic guitar simulator? Or that was yours. Whatever. Yeah, you finish off your work. They're building in a 20% buffer. And they market it as a benefit to their employees, which it probably is, but it's a very hard-nosed business decision. Why? Because Google is in an industry where time to market trumps everything else. They need to get to market faster than anybody else. They care about that speed. So because of that, they make a decision to sacrifice 20% of their employee knowledge and time, wasting it. Why? Faster cycle time. Think about your fire departments in your organization, at your home, right? You don't look at the fire departments and say, man, those guys just sit around washing their trucks and exercising all day. What a waste! We should fire all of them and just have one serving our metropolitan area so they're busy all the time. It would be crazy. No one would do that. Because time to your heart attack matters a lot. If the speed at which you're delivering stuff matters, watch out for utilization. When you walk by that really important person who has got that 12 boxes in his room, understand what you're doing is you're choking off your ability to move quickly. Time to feedback. You need the time to feedback. Okay. One last thing. There's a company in the Pacific Northwest. They have websites. They sell stuff out of their website, and I love it. They have a crack team of developers who know their product inside and out. They're the people who've been there from the start. And I swear they have their own parking spots and berets. I don't know if they do, but I mean, they're like really highly respected people. And they can check code into production, into a production website that does $1 billion a year, and they can check in from their laptop into that production website. No QA, no process. When do they do that? When the website is down. They are the firefighters. And they don't have 12 boxes of large things in their room. They don't get assigned any work at all. They're there for an emergency when the website is down or any part of the website is down. They're there to respond immediately. It's that valuable for that company. Now, are they wasting the rest of their time? Absolutely not. Those crack developers who know the product better than anybody else pair program the rest of their day. They'll find a developer, they'll sit down, and they'll transfer knowledge, and they'll work with people, they'll mentor them. I mean, how cool is that? They've taken something that's very valuable, and they use them in a way that I think is wise given what they're trying to accomplish. Keep the website up and transmit knowledge. In order to do this, you use WIP limits to constrain your queue size so that you can get feedback faster. Now, here's a case study. I'm going to do a case study, then I'm going to roll into a demo. Here's touch time for lead time for a sprint team. You can't really read it. The green is the duration. And then the completed work, the time it took to them to complete the work, is the yellow. And then as an extra thing, there's the work item count. And you can see there is a relationship between the two. The more work item counts they have, the longer the green things are. This is their touch time versus lead time, 3%. We talked a little bit about it. This team, we decided we needed to get them a little bit faster, a little bit better. So what we did, well, this is what they were doing. We measured one metric. And here they had all these design sign-offs. You may be in an organization where you can't get feedback by simply declaring you're going to reduce work in process. Because the people who have to make that have that authority may be one or two levels above you. They're the people that did the sign-off. This was the metric we chose. Oh, wait, first, these are the things they had control over. They had 19 items here, for example, and 13 items waiting. This is the problem. The senior folks were doing their sign-offs in batches. So look at this. The coding queue just piled up. They do an approval of a bunch of items and drop it in, and you have the equivalent of 12 giant boxes in everybody's room. And what happens? TFS sends an alert to the people who have subscribed to it, and they get on the phone and call development and say, hey, I hear it was approved, and you're working on my project. And now I got to provide status to all those folks. The cost of delay. This company measured ROI, and I love that they did that, because we could then turn this into the cost of delay. And we put this cost of delay on the sign-off. We put them on all columns. But it's how much is it costing that business to have those things just sitting there? And we did it weekly and cumulatively. And you'll notice it's down to 63,620. That is ridiculously accurate. We didn't know. We just did the subtraction, the multiplication, threw it out there. But imagine you're that senior exec who's doing, or senior architect who's doing that sign-off. You walk by, because these were on big visible displays, and you look at it and say, wait, Knut, what does this mean? $63,000 in cost for the thing sitting, waiting for my approval? And Knut says, we know you're really, really busy, but that's just how much it costs the company to not get these things through the process and start working on other stuff. That's going to exceed your salary pretty soon. So what is Knut's behavior? He starts modifying it. In fact, that's exactly what we saw, and this is what it looked like afterwards. We wanted faster feedback. What was preventing the feedback from getting to us quickly was Knut. We looked at what metric we could use, what proxy metric that we could use to get to our true metric, and we leveraged that for a period of time to change Knut's behavior. This is the importance of picking the right metrics. Spend time looking for the right metrics, identify them, and use them as leverage points. And we got much faster. You'll see the blue line at the top. That was the amount of lead time dropped pretty dramatically at the task level, but the hours of effort, green, didn't change much. It also, by the way, dropped bug counts, dramatically reduced the amount of bug counts. People are paying more attention. I want to open up and look at some lead times for some real development teams. And to do that, I'm going to go to a tool where I have a group of teams, and I want to walk through with you some actual metrics that are pulled from teams using TFS. TFS is the world's most brilliant system for gathering data, I think. I love it. I look at all of them. I don't have to focus on Microsoft's TFS, but I do, because it gathers the most data without having to impinge on people. So let's take a look at getting some cycle times and lead times from a real team. This team, the names have been changed, but this is real data. This is a ship team. Here's their cumulative flow. It means over time, you saw that, they went through new, estimated, active, resolved, and closed. I want to do something. I want to get rid of the new stuff because they haven't started working on that yet. And I want to get rid of, see the little humps, periodic humps? What type of team is this? Scrum team, exactly. And we can look at that and show estimated, active, and resolved, their work states, and you can see them kind of jumping up and down over time. You can also see their delivery dates. This is cycle time and lead time. Lead time is defined as starting at new and going to closed. Cycle time is defined as when it gets into their work state until they get it to closed. You'll notice it's a scrum team because when are they delivering? Every 2 months, they're closing things. Things don't appear on the cycle time and lead time until they're actually closed. What is so interesting is if we drill into that a little bit and look at the cycle time and lead time, you're going to find out some interesting things. At the very beginning, people are closing things right at the end points. What does that do to the testers in a Scrum team? What this feels like is developers are working the first 7 days or 8 days coding, and then, hi, testers, you got a day and a half, go finish. Right? And they crank through as fast as they can and finish. Because everything is being finished at the last minute. What do you think is happening when you look at these lead times and cycle times as they distribute towards the end? They're starting to spread out a little bit more, meaning that your developers are doing what they should in a Scrum team, and that's swarming. If you have 5 members on your Scrum team, day 1 of your sprint, you pick 2 items, maybe 3 items, and you pick small ones, and you swarm them, and you get them done so you can start handing stuff off to your testers. And you can see that team doing that. And you can see it right from here, because you're measuring this cycle time and lead time. I'm going to come back to this slide in a bit, but let's take a look at the testers and see if I'm right. This is the tester's work in process, their WIP. This is how much the testers are working on. This is their column. Look what it's doing. Their WIP before would skyrocket at the end of a sprint. They'd have so much to work on, and they'd have to burn it down really fast. Look later, and that is starting to spread out. It's becoming more consistent, more even, what you would want in a highly functioning, highly performing Scrum team. You can identify this. If we can look at it in story points. Look at the story points. New has almost no story points. Why? Because they haven't estimated it yet. Once it gets into estimated, they see it. But we can see, and when we look at the cumulative flow of story points, kind of that same behavior, but look what where the testers are at now. In story points, they're actually working on very small items that are left. How does that jibe with what's above? How it jibes with what's above is the testers are focused on the large story point items at the expense of the small story point items. I don't know if that's good or bad, but they're looking at the biggest, highest risk features, and that's where they're focusing their testing efforts. By the way, I've never met this team. I've never talked to anybody on this team. You can pull a lot just by looking. Pull a lot of data. I mean, pull a lot of understanding just by looking at the data. And then they've got some of their features. You can drill into their features, and you can see how big the team is, kind of by how many features they're working on, and how big the story, like this is 44 story points in this feature. If we drill in, here's all of these things. And let's go back up and look at the lead time. Lead time is from new to closed, right? So look what happens. This angle right here, this straight up line, all of the items that are on this line are items that were in the initial backlog when they started work. What is this team doing? They're shifting from those initial backlog items to work on new items that are clustering down below. So in other words, the team is no longer working off their main vision of the product. They've adjusted, and they're working off a different vision of the product, the new feedback-enabled vision of the product. I love that. I love that I can find that out and understand this team and then go talk to them. We can take a look at other teams that we might see, like reporting analytics. You see a cumulative flow here, and this is called a finger chart. What do you see here? Are they a Scrum team? What? Kanban. It's a continuous flow model with relatively balanced work. At this one, I've actually talked to someone on this team, and they are a team that's like that. And you can find out all sorts of things. Here, they don't have very many features they're working on, right? So they're not a very big team. On the other hand, we can do something like was it production fix? No. I have to remember the teams. No, one of these teams had just a crazy amount of catalog. They've got a lot of features they're working on, and the story points are giant underneath those features. This feature is 204 story points for that feature. Here's all the various features. Here's something that took a long time to ship. You click on it, and it opens it up, but we won't go there. Where am I? Back in their story point cumulative flow. we can start to just get an understanding of what kind of work they're doing and what their distributions are of work. Oops. These are metrics. And they're the second kind of metrics. They're the less important kind of metrics. The metrics I talked about first were the kind that you use to drive action and make changes in your org. These metrics are ones you look at behind the scenes to understand the teams and potentially promote one or two of these metrics to ones that will require active changes in the organization. Does that make sense? Let's go back to PowerPoints. I love this tool. Folks up front, you guys, Anthony, should I plug this in? I've always wanted to plug it into your company. I just haven't done it yet. Is it something we can do? Plug it in. Pull the data from your TFS server. Ray, can I do it? This just drags the data out and exposes it. All it is, it's internally at Northwest Cadence, we call it the wrap sheet. It's a reporting and analytics platform, right? But it shows where the problems are in the teams, and you can extract that. Your turn. Questions before we wrap in the last 1 minute and 30 seconds. Questions. And I'm up here. It's the last of the day, so I can take a lot. Yes, question. Yeah, so Mindy's question was, can we grab data from TFS and see all these statistics? The answer is absolutely yes. You can come up and talk with me, and I can show you how to do it yourself, and we can talk about how we can pull it too. But it's something you can pull. That data's all there in TFS, just ripe for the picking. You can do it yourself. You can do it with tools like this. There's other tools as well. Thank you, Mindy. Other questions? I love that question. If I'm a scrum team, what do I do to reduce the WIP? Normally, scrum teams reduce the WIP by reducing the time, the sprint length. But if you're Scrumbon, like I mentioned earlier, try to reduce the WIP at the beginning of a sprint to the development team to below the number of developers so they'll get something done really fast and get it to the testers. So that's a case where you do both. Shorten the time, but also shorten the WIP inside so developers can't each pick their own. If you have five developers who are working on five user stories, that's a problem at the beginning of a sprint. Other questions? Folks, I'm up here if you have more questions that you want to hit personally. Thank you very much, very much for attending, especially so late.